We are one short of a quorum, so we are going to start as a subcommittee in order to get the technical bill at least heard. And when the quorum-making member comes in, we will convene the meeting. I understand that the bill will be introduced. Meeting will come to order. Clerk will note the roll. Representative Simpson moves approval of the minutes of the 43rd meeting of the Tax Committee, which occurred on Wednesday, February 18, 2004. A copy of those minutes are in members' packets. As many as are in favor of that motion say aye. Aye. Those opposed say no. Motion prevails. We are now going to go to the technical bill. It will be introduced today, but for purposes of getting the bill before us, the chair will move that reviser number 04-3371 be recommended to pass and considered for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. And who wishes to present? Oh, Mr. Heck is here. This bill. And members, as I understand it, this bill is the product of the Revisor's Office, the Department of Revenue, House staff, and Senate staff. And the intention in this bill is for it to be purely technical and to go through that, and if there were any controversy about any of the provisions, they were to go to the policy bill. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Heck, and please identify yourself for the tape.
Greg Heck, Department of Revenue.
Therese Mitchell, Department of Revenue.
Oh, Therese, how are you?
Good, thank you, Mr.
Have we won any court cases lately, Therese?
not recently, sure.
Well, we got Krause out of the department, and he's no longer on tax court, so you shouldn't have any excuses.
Mr. Chair, committee members, as was mentioned, this is the department's technical bill, and it covers primarily sales and use taxes, special taxes such as gambling, cigarette and tobacco, insurance taxes, property tax and aids, and a miscellaneous section which has primarily some administrative provisions. These changes are technical in nature, primarily made for purposes of clarification, correcting obsolete citations, improving administration, and other miscellaneous changes, and the bill has no revenue impact as drafted. And the attorneys from the department will go through the articles, explain the changes, and try to answer any questions you might have.
Mr. Chairman, I'll start with Article 1, the sales and use tax article. Section 1 basically clarifies that if there's more than a 25% omission on a use tax return, the statute is extended to 6.5 years versus the normal 3.5-year statute limitation. This is similar to the way we treat sales and withholding tax currently. Section 2 is last year we amended the definition of bad debt for sales tax purposes under the streamline changes. Bad debt, though, is defined in Chapter 289A, which basically applies to all a number of tax types, and we're basically clarifying here that those changes only apply to sales tax, not to income tax or other taxes covered by Chapter 289A. Section 3 also is a streamlined provision. We're basically clarifying that the sourcing rules do apply. The general sourcing rules would apply to watercraft, aircraft, modular homes, manufactured homes, and mobile homes. Section 4 is merely correcting a cite from last year. This is dealing with sourcing, and it's purely technical. Section 5 also relates to streamlining. This was some language that was inadvertently omitted from last year's bill. It relates to transportation equipment, and we're inserting that language now to get in compliance with streamline. Section 6 is a technical change. We're correcting some cites to paragraphs. The paragraph references were paragraphs A and B last year when it was codified. Those paragraphs were classified as paragraphs 1 and 2. Section 3 might be argued as having a little more meat than those technical ones, but basically we're clarifying that the 1987 services, building, cleaning, lawn care, parking services, do not qualify for the industrial production exemption. About 4 years ago, the legislature gave them their own inputs exemption, which is now found in 297A.68, subdivision 3. That exemption is comparable to the industrial production exemption. Section 8 relates to capital equipment. We're also clarifying there those 1987 services, which I previously talked about, don't qualify for capital equipment treatment because they're basically not manufacturing, refining, or fabricating tangible personal property. We also added some language relating to preparation, furnishing of and serving of food by restaurants. This basically came out of a court case that we had in the department, the Leanne Chin's case. What we're basically doing here now is codifying the finding of the tax court. As initially drafted, there was some controversy about the language as I had drafted it. I have now talked to the attorney and the chief financial officer for Leanne Chin. I've talked to a representative from General Mills. We've added some language, adding the words by restaurants to clarify that it only applies to restaurants, not off-site food production facilities. And my understanding is they were going to circulate this in the food industry, and they had indicated they didn't have any concerns. As of today, I haven't heard of any concerns. Also, we're correcting a reference to equipment used for online data retrieval services. When the statute was recodified back in 2000, the word primarily was omitted. I've now talked to staff and revisor's office, and they agreed that this was an oversight, and so we're bringing the statute back where it should have been. Section 9 relates to something the legislature did last year. We added a provision last year saying that if the legislature increased the tax base for some reason or other, and it affected binding construction contracts, or there was a binding bid on a construction contract, there would be an automatic six-month window period or extension until that extension of the base would apply. What we're asking for here is also to apply that same concept if you actually raise the tax rate. This is something that, an issue that comes up every time the legislature raises the tax rate. Contractors come in and say that they're prejudiced by that. They've already got binding bids out there. They can't recoup the cost. So this would basically give them a six-month transition period. Section 10, we're basically repealing a number of obsolete and duplicative rules in the sales tax area. The vast majority of these come out of streamlined changes relating to a number of different issues, but or the statutory changes. But these were all included in the report that we that the department sent to the Legislative Commission on rules.
Are there any questions by any member on Article 1? Representative Cole.
With regard to Section 9, how would that play out if the legislature were to decide at some point that the sales tax rate ought to be lowered as opposed to raised?
Mr. Heck.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, if it was actually a decrease in the rates, it would work to the advantage of the contractors, and this transition period would only apply in rate increases. It wouldn't work to their detriment on a decrease.
Okay, onward to Article 2.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Pat Finnegan. I'm also an attorney in the Revenue Department, and I will take you through Article 2, the special taxes article. Section 1 deals with the mortgage registry tax. These taxes were recodified a couple years ago. Since then, we've come across an exemption in another statute in Chapter 193 that deals with mortgages on armories, and so we're referencing that in our exemption section of the mortgage registry tax. Section 2 deals with the Minnesota Care Tax definition of health care provider. It's eliminating a reference, an obsolete reference to residential care homes licensed under Chapter 144B. This chapter has been repealed, and we're replacing it with a reference to housing with services establishments registered under Chapter 144D. Section 3 is the petroleum tax penalty abatement authority. There is no specific penalty abatement authority in the petroleum tax chapter. We have general authority in Chapter 270, which we've used but we wanted to reference specific authority in the petroleum tax chapter. The next four or five sections, 4 through 8, are lawful gambling tax sections dealing with linked bingo. You may recall last session, the Gambling Control Board chapter 349 changed several definitions dealing with linked bingo. They're the regulators of lawful gambling. We are the taxing authority. So to be in sync with their changes, we're making the same changes in our statute.
Actually, Mr. Finnegan, to be linked with your being linked to the changes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Section 4 is the definition of distributor. We're including linked bingo game provider. Gambling product definition in Section 5 includes linked bingo paper sheets. Section 6 is a new definition of linked bingo game. And Section 7 is a new definition of linked bingo game provider. And then Section 8 is just of inspection rights, expanding the Commissioner of Revenue's authority to inspect the place of businesses of linked bingo game providers and to inspect their records and books. Section 9 deals with the cigarette tax and cigarettes specifically in interstate commerce. This was a section that was enacted last session, and it requires reports to be filed with the Department of Revenue for out-of-state shipments of certain cigarettes. And this is going to clarify that the reports are only required in relation to certain cigarettes. The cigarettes manufactured by companies that are not original or subsequent participating manufacturers in the master settlement agreement. Section 10 and 11 deals with the June accelerated tax. Section 10 deals with the cigarette tax, and Section 11 is the tobacco tax. The June acceleration had been repealed a couple years ago, and it was reenacted last session. And this is clarifying the return dates for those distributors that are subject to accelerated payment requirements. Section 12 is a new definition of reinsurance for our insurance premiums tax. We have a definition of gross premium, which excludes premiums for reinsurance, but we never had a definition of reinsurance, so that's what this is. And Section 13 is a reaction to a Supreme Court case of CUNA versus the Commissioner. And what we're doing there simply is removing the phrase property and casualty from that section. And that's going along with what the Supreme Court held. And Section 14 is a repealer. It deals again with the lawful gambling tax provision for allocation of payments. The department has a general allocation of payments section in Chapter 270, which would apply to lawful gambling tax as well. So we decided to attempt to repeal the specific provision in that chapter.
Any questions by members on Article 2 of this bill? Moving to Article 3.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Lance DeRica for the Department of Revenue. Article 3 has to do with property taxes. First section has to do with payment of current year taxes when a title to a mobile home is changed. We're clarifying that the current year taxes have to be paid. Otherwise, there'd be possible confusion about what the levy date was or is. Section 2 adds two cross-references to provisions that exist already. Adds one cross-reference to provision that exists already, letting the letting the Department of Revenue verify to the local assessor whether someone has filed as a resident in the most recent year upon request. And that, again, that's a reference to an existing provision. Section 3 incorporates two references to existing provisions in the statute that first of all starts out and says when exempt property is leased, loaned, or otherwise made available to somebody in a business for profit, we're going to tax that property. We're adding two references to existing provisions that exempt certain arrangements or leases from that tax. Section 4 is a provision regarding property tax exemptions. It said that the exemptions for property tax in this statute are limited by other provisions. Those other provisions are obsolete now, and so we're just putting in kind of a boilerplate language that the exemptions are limited to other provisions of law. Somewhat similarly, Section 5 is the exemption, main property tax exemption for charities, property of purely public charities. The language that's being stricken refers to obsolete provisions, so there's no sense in having that exception from the exemption. However, we are adding several lines, 8 through 17 on page 23, clarifying that certain government subsidies for low-income housing are not gifts for determining whether the landlord or the owner is a charity, charitable institution. Section 6 is kind of a long, convoluted new language, but all it's trying to do in the first part, paragraph A, is reiterate the property tax exemption that exists for property subject to the taconite production tax. And paragraph B, we're doing the same thing for property that's property that's used in mining that's subject to the net proceeds tax. And again, this would be existing provisions of law that we're just putting into the main property tax exemption statute. Section 7, 8, and 9 are the same thing. They're adding language in the main property tax exemption statute to refer to other provisions of law which already exist and which already provide exemptions from the property tax. Section 10 is an attempt to clarify just a bit the types of non-human entities that can get property tax homesteads. Pretty clear, and we've gone through this a couple times since 1999, but we found there was a little bit of a uncertainty with the reference to limited liability companies, whether it could be just an authorized limited liability company or a limited liability company that's operating a family farm. And if you're following along in the bill on page 24, we wanted to make sure that the phrase family farm on line 33 modified both partnership on line 33 and limited liability company on line 32. And the rest of the changes in that section are just conforming to that, a matter of style. Section 11 goes back to the earlier provisions where we were just putting in references to exemptions that exist already. The statute being amended in Section 11 is complementary to the statute I mentioned before when property is leased, loaned, or otherwise made available to an entity for engaged in a business for profit. This statute says if you take exempt property and make it available to anyone under a lease of more than a year, whether that's for the person is engaged in profit making or not, the property is going to become taxable. And this just incorporates a reference to property under cooperative farming agreements with DNR or lease agreements executed when a governmental entity acquires property under condemnation but doesn't kick the person out right away. Section 12 changes the time period for a certification of compliance. This has to do with stuff we enacted last year for local boards of appeal and equalization. In 2005, the commissioner is going to be preparing a booklet for the local boards outlining their duties and responsibilities and how the meeting should be conducted. because we have got some complaints about that. That again, that's something we did last year. As a part of what we did last year, we said the local board is going to have to certify that they've complied with quorum requirements and training requirements, and it's just a reference to what year. In December of 2006, they're going to be certifying their compliance in 2006, not their compliance in 2005. So the word, we strike prior and put in current. Section 13 has to do with the county board. We're eliminating some language that says they must meet on the last 10 meeting days of June, because now the law says they can meet on any consecutive 10 days after the second weekend if they publish the dates on the tax statements. And since the dates of those meetings have to be on the tax statements, the first sentence in there is really not needed. Section 14 changes the date by which the home county auditor must certify proposed levies to other county auditors for taxing jurisdictions that overlap counties. The current date that these information must be shared by September 20th is a little early in the process, and so we're changing that date to October 5, which we think will still allow the rest of the stuff that has to happen on a timely basis. Section 15 strikes a reference to reducing taxes for disparity reduction aid. Another section of the law tells the auditor to adjust tax rates for the disparity reduction aid, so we're eliminating this conflicting instruction. Section 16 has to do with a certain report that the department gets in October on property tax levies, and we're just striking the sentence that says the report must show the amount of the special levies. Our practice has been to sometimes not include that information on this particular report. Section 17 changes the date by which the county treasurers must transfer to the state by electronic means the state property tax levies that have been monies that have been collected in the first half of the year for the May payments. Right now it says on or before June 30th, but if June 30th is on a Saturday, then they don't have to do it till the next Monday, and that might be in July sometime. So we're changing that law, saying two business days before June 30th to make sure that we always get that money in June and not in July, because then it would cross a fiscal year. Section 18 changes a fairly old provision of law that says certain county officials can't purchase tax forfeited lands unless they were the prior owner. And we're just clarifying that that applies to county officers in the county where the land, tax forfeited land is located. So county officers and employees would be able to bid on tax forfeited land in other counties. And this is how we currently interpret that. Sections 19.
Oh, Representative Magnus has a question. Representative Magnus.
Since I'm sitting next to an attorney,
Representative, I think the answer to that would be for the same reason. I was going to use the sheriff. I was going to say it's the same reason the sheriff isn't restricted from this. And what I'm trying to get at is the county attorney really doesn't play a role in the tax forfeiture process unless something gets messed up. These are the people who have inside information, if you will, on the process, and I don't think the county attorney would be in that category.
It wouldn't in my county, but that's my county. I mean, it's small in the rural area, they may know more.
Could we, let's see, would that be Karen? Could you flag that, Karen, and pursue Representative Magnus's concern? We will learn more, Representative Magnus. We will get to the bottom of this. Why aren't the attorneys involved? Mr. Strika.
Sections 19, 20, and 21 clarify, have to do with Chapter 282 of the statutes, which is in large part how we, the government, disposes of tax forfeited land after all of the redemption periods have expired and so forth. And Chapter 282 has a lot of provisions in it. Some of them have to do with sales by the Department of Natural Resources. Most of the sales are run-of-the-mill, and the Department of Revenue executes a deed for the purchaser on behalf of the state. But there are some other sections in that chapter where, as I said, the Commissioner of Natural Resources or the Commissioner of Finance might be writing the deed. And right now there's not a real clear reference to which parts of those chapters, if the purchase is under what that part of the chapter, who is to execute on the deed on behalf of the state, and this just clarifies that. Section 22 eliminates on page 33 a paragraph that defines the local government, the so-called local government aid, city aid base for cities. This is something that should have been stricken in the 2003 tax bill, but was not.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Marquardt.
Mr. Chair, would you entertain a motion to strike Section 22 today?
No.
Mr. Chair, I don't think that should have been deleted at all. I think it's a perfect provision.
Well, I would think that Representative Mullery would have a far different view of this provision. Any? Once again, carrying the water for Minneapolis and St. Paul.
That's appropriate.
Mr. Sturica.
Section 23. Clarify some appropriations for public defender costs and the costs associated with court ordered counsel. I don't think this is the... I don't think this is the local impact. This clarifies the appropriations for the cost of local impact fiscal notes and public defender costs from the tax bill last year. And again, it just clarifies those appropriations for the particular year. Section 24, we'll take credit for internally. The language, this has to do with 2004 city aid reductions that were enacted last year, and the current language talks about initial aid reductions being applied to a city's local government aid distribution, but the initial aid reduction is already accounted for in that local government aid. So we're eliminating some language on page 40 and trying to restate the process a little more clearly on page 39. If the final aid reduction is more than what their local government aid has been reduced by, the excess comes from the market value homestead credit reimbursement. Just clarifying that. Section 25 clarifies the levy plus aid revenue base for the certain of the aid reductions, I think it was for counties and cities. That the attached machinery aid component will not be a part of, is not a part of the levy plus aid revenue base for those purposes.
I would suspect that Representative Anderson thinks that that's a very, very good provision. Please continue.
Then section 26 is the repealer. One, two, three, four. Three things are being repealed in the bill, and I believe there's an amendment to repeal a fourth. 273.19 subdivision 5 provides a limited exemption for certain hydroelectrical or hydromechanical facilities. There's already an unlimited exemption in our main property tax exemption statute, so this one is superfluous. 275.15 has a reference to certain levy limits within a string of statutes that don't contain levy limits, so that reference is being repealed. 283.07 has to do with refunds of taxes for railroad lands that were exempt, but we thought they were sold, so they became taxable, but in fact they weren't sold and became taxable. But since that's not the way railroad property is, it's not exempt from property tax at all to begin with, this refund statute in that situation is not needed anymore.
Okay, there is an amendment that goes right here, the KB 70 amendment. You reference, Mr. Sturica? It is in members' packets. Why don't we put that one on right now, and then you can explain it. Chair will move the KB 70 amendment. As many as are in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. Amendment is adopted. Mr. Sturica, can you explain the KB 70 amendment?
Mr. Chair, that amendment amends Section 26 that I just discussed to add another section that would be repealed. This would be Minnesota Statutes 274.05.
Yeah.
Excruciating detail, what 274.05 deals with is certain certifications that the county auditor is to give to the county assessor when A, the county assessor turns over the books in the year, and B, when the county assessor provides certain summaries of those books properly subtotaled at the bottom of each page. Since the statute which requires the assessor to do those things has been repealed last year, this statute which requires the auditor to give the assessor a certification when they do those things is not needed anymore.
Representative Burrell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If we could go back to page 20 in the bill, section 2, I have a question on line 17 where the department may turn over information to the county assessor. I'm wondering if this has or is covered in Chapter 13 if it's allowed under the Data Practices Act.
Mr. Chair, Representative, the short answer is yes, it is. Again, this section in the bill, as you can see, is adding a reference to an existing provision in 273.124 that says the Department of Revenue can basically share some information from an income tax return with the county assessor when the county assessor asks. Instead of Chapter 13, I think the tax information, the privacy of that, and the protection of that is governed by Chapter 270B that's being amended here. And we refer to the definitions of private and protected and so forth in Chapter 270B, but 270B is where the tax information is made private. This repeats an exception to that, where the department is going to release some information to the county assessor upon request. And again, that provision exists, and we're just putting a reference to it here in Chapter 270B, which is our main tax data statute.
For instance, Representative Burrell, if the assessor sees a car parked for the summer months with Florida plates, okay, and they don't see the smaller jurisdiction, the residents around for 7-8 months a year, the assessor sees that there is a homestead classification on the property. And one of the ways you catch people who are taking homesteads who aren't entitled to the homesteads is call the Department of Revenue and ask, did the people who live at this piece of property file a Minnesota income tax return as a resident, or did they file a non-resident return? And that would, of course, I don't think you would support having people who are, for income tax purposes, trying to establish residency in another state take advantage of having a homestead in Minnesota. And I think that that's what this provision is getting at. Am I correct, Mr. Starica?
Mr. Chair, I agree exactly. Good example.
Okay, any more questions on Article 3? Representative Broad, better stay close, Mr. Starica.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd say Representative Magnus had some good questions, I think, on Section 18. I want to jump back there for a minute if I could. When we're looking at that section, it talks about the employee and the office, the county assessor, district court, et cetera, but it doesn't talk about the families. Even in raffles, we talk about that family members are excluded from participating in the raffle because of an appearance of possibility of improprieties. So what's the point of excluding these people if you're not excluding family members?
Mr. Starica.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would hesitate to talk about legislative intent with regard to this provision because I believe it is quite old, older than anybody in the room. You have a good point. We get questions along those lines from counties all the time, and all I can tell you is the way the provision is written is the way it's written. We, at this point, we're only trying to clarify that these people were not restricted. The people who are named aren't restricted in other counties. We, at this time, weren't going on to tackle that other issue of shouldn't this circle be larger within the county. That's a discussion we could certainly be willing to have. We do get those questions.
Representative Mullery has a question. Representative Mullery.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering why we couldn't cross-check those with computers, and Mr. Michael said they did start doing that for a while, but didn't work out well. Is there some reason that it didn't work, or...
I think we'd have to ask Mr. Mike. You know, there were. I think that they were catching too many false positives, Representative Mullery. But I'll let Mr. Michael or the department to talk about the non-resident filer filing for a homestead and how the department's computer match has worked or not worked. But my recollection is there were too many false positives, but.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'm trying to think through whether this is a false type A error, type B, a false positive. I think what it boils down to is just because you're it boils down to a couple things. Your return may show a Florida address. You may file as a resident and show a Florida address, but that doesn't mean anything other than maybe you wanted your refund check to go to your mother or something. So there is a problem with just routinely sharing address type information from tax returns. Again, if you file the other type of false positive that can occur is you can file as a Minnesota resident for income tax purposes, but you still might not be entitled to the property tax homestead. So it's something the way this is written and the way we talk to assessors is to use this information as a factor to support other information or as a clue to lead you to other investigations. But in a lot of high percentage of the cases, the income tax information is not determinative that you aren't entitled to the homestead or that you are.
And quite often, Representative Mullery, you have to look not only at the Minnesota income tax return, you have to look at, for purposes of itemizers, the federal income tax return, because you could have a Minnesota address there. You may have had some Minnesota income that you have to disclose because of property ownership or whatever. So, but have the bulk of your income being reported to other states. So gets into a lot of false data gets into it just with the computer matrix and the Mueller.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I understand that it's probably harder, you might say that, to qualify on the as the homestead than the other, but I just thought that would be a trigger that they'd an aid to the assessor to look into.
Mr.
I certainly don't think it should be determinant.
Yeah, but the problem is that if you, you know, Joel maybe has to add to it, but if what you do is you yank 100,000 returns and there's only 5,000 who are claiming a false homestead, query is the effort in order to ferret out through that method those 5,000 worth it. Joel?
Mr. Chairman, just maybe a little bit of background information on this. When the department started doing this, I believe in the early 90s, as a result of the sort of the BOSS database effort, they discovered that there were a very large percentage of homestead filers that neither filed a Minnesota individual income tax return nor a property tax refund. And that, of course, I think it was in the range of almost 10% of homesteads, something in that neighborhood. It's a very, very large number. They did some initial investigation and discovered that most of the ones that they looked at, of course, that was legitimate because these folks did not have enough income, taxable income, to be required to file a tax return, but they had enough exempt income so that they didn't qualify for the property tax refund. And so I think what the department made a judgment that it was not, that it would be not efficient or it would be counterproductive for them to notify local assessors of everybody that didn't file an individual income tax return for the state as a resident that also had a homestead, because as the chair puts it, most of those would be in fact false positives. And so what they're seeking here is a more targeted way of saying if the assessor approaches them, they do have the authority to say to the assessor, yes, this individual has not filed a resident individual income tax return, but will not send, you know, the other, you know, thousands of notices that really would not result in any compliance activity.
Any other questions on Article 3? Article 4, miscellaneous. Mr. Hector, back in. A member has a question. I happen to know the answer to it, but you'll probably be able to answer it far quicker than I am. Can you explain linked bingo?
Mr. Chairman, that was actually Mr. Finnegan. I'll let you explain.
Oh, Finnegan! How come I always think of you and linked bingo, Mr. Heck? Mr. Finnegan, could you explain to the members of the committee linked bingo?
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Pat Finnegan. Linked bingo is a lawful gambling game that was authorized by the legislature last session. It was, I think currently the Gambling Control Board is going through the rules-making process in order to implement it. But what it does is it allows organizations to combine prizes, and have larger prizes. So I think the intent of it would be to get more people to participate in these games and have larger prizes. It would allow organizations at different sites to link together electronically and have bingo occasions. I think there's a prize limit of a maximum of $300 per organization per occasion. So depending on the number of organizations that participate would determine the extent of the prize limit. Not sure if that answers the question.
I think we all know more about linked bingo now than we cared to know. Thank you, Mr. Finnegan. Article 4, the miscellaneous tax section. Mr. Hecht is back.
Mr. Chairman, this is the miscellaneous tax article, and it covers a number of the tax types that are administered by the department. It starts on page 41 of the bill. Section 40, or Section 1 deals with the date of assessment. Basically, when the department does an audit and the taxpayer agrees with that audit, they sign a consent agreement, and this basically just provides that the notice date on that assessment agreement is the date of assessment and the date that actually establishes the debt to the state. Section 2 relates to the Minnesota estate tax return, and it basically provides that we'll grant an automatic extension up to 6 months to file the estate tax returns. They're due 9 months after the date of death. Currently, they have to show reasonable cause. This does not extend the payment date. They still would have to pay the tax by the due date, but they'd have 6 months to file the return. Section 3 relates to sending orders by electronic mail. If the taxpayer requests that we extend it to them electronically, this would give us the authority to do that. Section 4 relates to civil fraud penalty, and it basically provides that we can impose a civil fraud penalty if someone also fails to file a return with the intent to evade the tax to the same extent as if they actually filed a return with that intent. Sections 5 and 6 are income tax provisions. They basically provide that for both purposes of imposing the tax and giving credits, that we're using the same definitions of net income. It also corrects a site in 290.01 relating to the definition of resident. Section 7 also relates to income tax. This relates to the curriculum areas of study that would qualify for the education credit. We're basically correcting sites here. The statute currently refers to Chapter 120B, Sections 01 and 021, and we're correcting those references that were made last year.
So this, Mr. Heck, would make the ninth straight year in which we're correcting problems in the education credit, correct?
Mr. Chairman, I can't say with certainty, but I know we've made changes a number of years. Yes. Section 8 relates to the personal liability standard for withholding tax. Right now, it applies to anyone who has legal control. We would remove the word legal, and now it would apply to anyone who has legal or actual control, and this would make it consistent with the standard we now use for withholding and other trust tax purposes. Sections 9 and 10 relate to the Sustainable Forest Incentive Act. Section 9 basically provides, currently the statute would lead you to believe that if you fail to file your annual certification, you would automatically be kicked out of the program. What this provision would now say is that we would treat that failure to file return on time as a violation. The commissioner would then give you notice and you would have a right to have a hearing or appeal that. This is basically codifying the way the department currently administers it. We wouldn't automatically kick someone off for such a ministerial mistake as missing it by a couple days. Section 10 is a little more complicated. This one basically deals with how long the covenant applies. And I know when the department went through this with staff, there were some questions on whether the language was precise enough. And so we'd certainly be willing to work with staff if they have comments. It basically provides, though, if you pull out the program within the first 4 years, what happens? And also after 4 years, what happens? Basically, under the current statute, the covenant has to provide or apply for a minimum of 8 years. Then we also provide that if the land is actually taken for public purposes by eminent domain or whatever, those covenant provisions would be released. Section 11 relates to the Unfair Cigarette Sales Act, which the department happily got rid of a couple of years ago. That was transferred to the Department of Commerce. And we're repealing some language here. Dealing with the repeal of licenses issued by the department, we wouldn't want the Commissioner of Commerce to exercise those authorities.
Mr. Heck, does the Commissioner of Commerce have any more enthusiasm for the Unfair Cigarette Sales Act than the Department of Revenue had?
Mr. Chairman, I would be surprised if they did, but we haven't heard any comments or complaints from them, but I think no one really wanted that particular provision.
Well, I'm a vote for repeal, but I'm just one.
Section 12 relates to the Metropolitan Solid Waste Landfill penalties, and we're basically just clarifying there that the penalties are the same penalties that apply to the corporate franchise tax. This is merely clarification. Section 13, we're basically repealing two rules here. One relates to withholding tax or estimated tax for corporations, and that's repeal is necessitated by the enactment of 289A.26, which is much clearer and more precise than the rule. And we're also repealing Rule 8093.3000, because the statutory provision for the underlying rule has now been repealed.
Any questions on Article 4? Now, one other amendment has come forward from House research that the department signed off on. There's a third amendment which I suggested needed a little bit discussion that will be which should be part of the policy bill dealing with airports, and I just felt that it was not of really technical stuff. I thought that there was some policy behind it, so that one we'll be hearing later. But we have the A040891 amendment. The chair will move the A040891 amendment. As many as are in favor of that amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, say no. Motion prevails. The amendment is adopted. Therese, could you explain this amendment and what's going on here?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I cannot, but we do have someone who can, Mark Peterson, and I'll ask him to do it.
Okay. Mr. Peterson, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Mark Peterson. I'm an attorney with the department. This amendment really started back in 2000 when we did an insurance recodification that repealed all of the insurance provisions and moved all of them into 297I. And that bill was passed separately in, let's say, April of 2000. And then in May of 2000, the omnibus tax bill was passed. And as part of that, a change in the way that HMOs, nonprofit health service plans, and community integrated service networks was made in the omnibus bill. And when that bill was passed, the change was to 6815, which had been repealed in the recodification. Now, there was a note to the reviser, telling the reviser, rewrite this provision and place it into the new insurance recodification chapter. And during that process, the words that are being put back in through this amendment got left out through the rewrite by the reviser.
Any questions? Okay. Does anybody in the audience wish to testify on any provision in the technical bill? Well, the way that we have proceeded around here, literally every bill, but for sure on the technical bill, if anything comes up between now and when we are marking up the omnibus tax bill, please let either my office or staff know about anything that may have some controversy, because at least in this bill there's every attempt made to have the technical bill really technical, and there'll be plenty of things to disagree about in other bills, I guarantee you. But as always, if something comes up, please let my office know, staff know, or the department know, and we'll certainly try to make every effort to accommodate. Currently, members, we have Representative Lanchesky.
Mr. Chair, I just have a question not related to this, related to our calendar as tax committee. The Department of Revenue sent us all, I think every legislator recently, just a brief synopsis of their performance as a department. And in that, they referenced the individual income tax compliance study that's supposed to be done, I think it's early 2004. Are you going to have a hearing on that, or will we review that as a committee? I know we did. I think you had a hearing when we had the sales tax study that was done by Revenue a couple of years ago, showing the gap between, you know, what should be paid in compliance. And I know that other study will be coming out. Do you intend us to spend any time on that this year?
The short answer is yes, Representative Lanchesky. If it's important enough for a report to be asked for by the legislature, and this is requested by the legislature, and given the importance of the subject matter, because we do we do live in a state in which we have extraordinary voluntary compliance. I think that it's important to review compliance efforts and take a look at where there may be difficulties, because that leads right back into what's the tax policy and what's the problem. It's been my experience that sometimes compliance problems are simply either the legislature and the executive branch being unclear, because I think that people do want to comply. But it's a good kind of bird, canary in the mine shaft, if we start seeing compliance shift. And, you know, some of the other things that would be part of such a hearing would be the annual performance review by the department. They do have some benchmarks that they look at. There was some monies for additional enforcement that I understand, at least through anecdote, was very successful. But I do think that it is worth one hearing of the tax committee's time to go through kind of the nuts and bolts of the department. And what I normally try to do is try to bundle them together at one hearing, because it's the same cast of characters from the department tend to be involved in all three of those areas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Mallory.
Mr. Chairman, do you have an idea on the schedule for the next 2 weeks?
Well, I can't tell you for the next 2 weeks. I can tell you that next week, right now, we do not have a hearing scheduled. The bills that are currently before the committee are, with all respect to the bill's authors, a pretty unexciting group. And, you know, frankly, we're going to have a revenue forecast that's going to be coming out at the end of February. And the policy bill still hasn't been signed off by the governor. You know, my style has always been to try to get the policy bill and the technical bill and some of and the studies and that sort of thing heard, so that when it comes time to try to assemble some of the more controversial items in the tax bill, that we don't have to go back to this stuff. But, you know, frankly, we've hit a dead spot. And, you know, as I said last year, when we hit a dead spot, I know we're going to pay for it down the road, because we're not going to rush. You know, we're not going to be unveiling new provisions on a Wednesday and expect the members to be in a position to think about and vote for it on Thursday. That just isn't the style around here. So next week, Representative Mallory, you know, there may be an email coming out in which my mind has been changed and there would be a reason to meet. But right now, it is really thin gruel out there. You know, we can have, we could have the annual hearing on single factor sales. We could have the annual meeting on AMT, but I think until we see the governor's budget, and at least I've had some opportunity to think about these issues and put something definitive in bill form as kind of a direction that at least those of us in the majority are looking for, you know, we're just talking philosophically about the issue, and that, you know, sometimes is good and sometimes is bad, but I don't want to waste members' time. Representative Mallory.
I think I would probably not disagree with what you were saying. I think the word exciting might not be. There's some exciting bills. I mean, I agree with them, but or as to any chance of going anywhere, there's some very interesting proposals.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Lachesky.
Just a response to your comments, and I agree with you that we should wait on that, but I certainly hope, if the numbers permit at all, some of those annual things like single sales will get addressed this year. But I'm just wondering, for the TIF technical bill, will that be something? I've had a number of people talk to me about provisions in that, and I've kind of told people, rather than creating individual bills, to see if things can be addressed in a more technical way, and I'm just wondering what your plans for that are this year.
Our plans are the same as always. We will have a TIF working group, because and it will require unanimous agreement by the TIF working group to bring things forward, Representative Lencheski, and it will be the same as in the past. And We normally fire that up a little bit closer to the public finance bill and the omnibus tax bill. We normally fire that group up. And if there are provisions that members are interested in, they ought to bring them forward. If there's some individual bills, I did see and talk very briefly to Representative Hillstrom about another Brookdale problem. And, you know, the TIF form is at Mr. Tremere's office and ready to go, but we're going to handle that the same way we've always handled it, or at least we've handled it since Ann Rest was chair of the committee. With that, we are adjourned for the day. Thank you, members.